Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin from Chicago, Mishkin Law, and we got another great episode for you guys today on the Deadhead Cannabis Show. We're featuring a show that I attended way back in 1993 on March 11th, 31 years ago today, at the Rosemont Horizon in Rosemont, Illinois, which is just outside of Chicago, right across the highway from the airport. Not necessarily the best place to see a show, but certainly the place where we saw a lot of Dead shows in the 1980s. They would squeeze us all in there, and Dead would come out and play away, and we always had a good time, and March 11th, 93 was no exception. So let's dive right in and listen to how they opened the show that night. Help on the Way, the kickoff tune for the Help on the Way, Slipknot, Franklin's Tower. Suite of songs. We talked about Slipknot a week or two ago, and we've talked about Franklin's Tower quite a bit. Help on the Way, Jerry Garcia, Robert Hunter tune. Always the lead song when they're playing that whole trio of songs. And here they open the show with it. And, you know, anytime you go into a Grateful Dead show and they come out roaring with Help on the Way, Slipknot, into Franklin's, you have to decide right there and then that this is just going to be a pretty darn good night. And, you know, we just take it from there. And this was a great night. It was the final night of a three-night run at the Rosemont Horizon, which was a pain in the ass to get to because we'd be driving out there during traffic. And, yes, this was a very standard three-show run for them, a Tuesday through a Thursday. You know, and presumably they did it to minimize the crowd so that, you know, people who worked all week in other cities but would travel to Chicago, and you could fly into O'Hare Airport, and it was literally a two-minute cab ride, you know, for people who wanted to just pop in and pop out. And so we figured they did it in the middle of the week just to make life difficult, you know, for the out-of-towners, but it made life difficult for us, too. You got to leave work downtown early. At that point in time, well, you could take the train out there, but it didn't go to the Horizon. You would have to then get onto a bus and something else. So, of course, we'd always just all wind up driving, although sometimes if I was downtown late, I'd take the train and then get picked up out there and by one of the airport parking lots, and then we would zoom over to the show. Parking there was always a disaster. If you pulled into the actual lot, you had to be prepared for an hour, hour and a half, if not more, on the back end, because there was no lines. People just parked everywhere once you pulled in. Presumably they would have rows where you were supposed to park, but nobody ever really followed it. And so, you know, if you came out, you could have cars completely surrounding your car, so you couldn't move until enough of them came and moved. And then, you know, there were no lines. People just, you know, trying to get to the exit from whichever direction they were coming from. And so there was a hotel next door, and for a while we all learned the trick that you could go park in the hotel parking lot and then just simply, you know, walk an extra 10 feet across a little grassy divide that they had. But somewhere along the way, the hotel got smart about that And they put up a gate, you know, a parking gate, and you had to get a ticket when you went in and then pay when you went out. And it wasn't really any cheaper, although it was still more convenient. So we would do that for a long time. But, you know, always a difficult place. And the Rosemont police were no fun. They weren't fun. They didn't even try to be fun. Their presence outside of the arena before the shows was always so strong and so obvious and very, very in your face. And they'd be lining up around the arena to really make sure that nothing improper was going on, you know, looking for people who they thought they might want to hassle if they looked like they might have drugs on them or something like that. And after the show especially, you know, when people came stumbling out of there, if you bumped into the wrong cop at the wrong time, you could have a problem. And in fact, one night we came out of there and we were all buzzing pretty good. And as we were walking to the car, I hear out of, you know, a cop yelling, "Hey, stop, stop right there." And I'm thinking, okay, well, I hope whoever it is stops. And I'm just minding my own business. I'm not running or anything. I'm just walking, cutting through the cars to get over to my car. And then I hear, "Hey, dude, we said stop, stop right now." And I'm like, "Huh? What? What are you talking about?" And then all of a sudden, three cops come running up to me. "We said stop." Why? I'm like, "I'm sorry, I didn't know." And I stopped, you know, freaking out. Why are they stopping me? I had some weed in my pocket. And one of the cops says, "Show me that T-shirt." I'd bought a T-shirt inside or somewhere, and I had it slung over my shoulder. And I took the T-shirt off, and I opened it up so he could see. He goes, "Yeah, you see?" And he pointed to his buddy, one of the other cops. "Yeah, isn't that funny? Okay, you can go. That's all. I just wanted to show my buddy your T-shirt." I'm like, I almost pissed in my pants. You're sitting there screaming at me like you want me to stop, like I just come. But that was the Rosemont Horizon. But the Dead played great shows there. Really, really good shows. This one was no exception. This whole set was a really good run of shows. And, you know, we enjoyed it all. And you put up with what you have to put up with. But when you get there and they open up with Help on the Way, you know, all the other issues just kind of fade away. We know the song was released on Blues for Allah in 1975. The Dead played it 111 times. It was first played on June 17th, 1975 at the Winterland in San Francisco, From the Vault Volume 1. We talked about the From the Vault volumes a few weeks ago. The last time it was played was June 22nd, 1995 at the Knickerbocker Arena up in Albany, New York, a prime spot for the Grateful Dead to play, and they released a three-disc set of shows rocking at the Nick, or dozing at the Nick, with the whole Rip Van Winkle theme to it, which three really good discs with a lot of good cuts of a lot of good songs. No full show there, just different songs they selected from the various nights. But still, you know, great Grateful Dead music, and always fun to listen to. So, yeah, Help on the Way. It's a great way to start. You know, everybody's in a good mood. And a little bit further along in the first set, we get the Dylan for the Day cover. When I Paint My Masterpiece is a 1971 song written by Bob Dylan. It was first released by The Band, who you know was Dylan's band for a long time. They recorded the song for their album Cahoots, released on September 15th, 1971. Dylan himself first recorded the song at New York's Blue Rock Studio, where he was backed by Leon Russell and session musicians, including Jesse Ed Davis on lead guitar, And it appeared on Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits Volume 2, released on November 17th, 1971, with Russell credited as the producer. Dylan and the band performed the song together live in the early hours of January 1st, 1972, at a New Year's Eve concert by the band, a recording that was released as a bonus track on the 2001 CD reissue of the band's live album, Rock of Ages. Douglas Brinkley, while interviewing Dylan for the New York Times in 2020, noted that When I Paint My Masterpiece was a song that had grown on him over the years, and asked Dylan why he brought it back to the forefront of recent concerts. Dylan replied, "It's grown on me as well. I think this song has something to do with the classical world, something that's out of reach, someplace you'd like to be beyond your experience, something that is so supreme and first rate that you could never come back down from the mountain, that you achieved the unthinkable. That's what the song tries to say. And you'd have to put it in that context and saying that, though, even if you do paint your masterpiece, what will you do then? Well, obviously, you have to paint another masterpiece." According to his official website, Dylan played the song live 182 times between 1975 and 2019. So that does not take into some of his more current touring that we've been talking about, the Rough and Rowdy Waves tour. He has 5 live performances of the song from Dylan's 1975 Rolling Thunder review that were released on the box set, the Rolling Thunder review, the 1975 live recordings released in 2019. The live debut occurred at the War Memorial Auditorium in Plymouth, Massachusetts on October 30th, 1975, and the most recent performances occurred on the Rough and Rowdy Ways Worldwide Tour of 2023, so that we do have that, just don't have the specific dates. As for the Grateful Dead, they played the song 146 times, first played on June 13th, 1987 at Ventura County Fairgrounds in Ventura, California, last played on July 9th, 1995 at Soldier Field in Chicago, the last show, so played it right up until the very end there. It's one of my very favorite Dylan covers that the Grateful Dead play. For a long time in the mid to late 80s, it would rotate in the first set with their certain other Dylan covers, including Queen Jane Approximately, Stuck Inside of Mobile with those Memphis Blues Again, and Desolation Row. And that doesn't even count all the other Dylan covers that they would play that would pop up in all different parts of the show. But this was a great tune, and what I like about this clip is that on the chorus you have Jerry singing in the background, and he's singing it in a way to make his voice very distinctive, but not overpowering. So Bobby's the lead singer, but you get Jerry back there, and he does that on times. Sometimes on Samson and Delilah, Tear This Old Building Down, and really drag it out. And I always liked it because it just says to me, you know, Jerry's tuning in. He's paying attention to what's going on. He's not just up there strumming the guitar, and he's having a good time. He you know, he wants to be part of it. In fact, the first time I ever heard a cover of this tune was Jerry doing it. And there are recordings out there of Jerry or the Jerry Garcia Band or whoever he's playing with at the moment where he sings it. And I like that version just as much as I do when Bobby sings it. It's a great tune. It's a lot of fun. The kids in concert really like it when he talks about playing in the Coliseum. And if you're playing in, you know, one of the indoor arenas like the Hampton Coliseum, everybody goes wild and screams and yells and, you know, all that kind of dead on cue, a deadhead stuff on cue that we, you know, that we all love and go to the concerts to see and, you know, sometimes be a part of. So they're off to a good start with this show, and they're really cranking along. And we will get back to it in 1 minute. I want to talk some music, though, some other stuff that's going on. First and foremost, last week, so last Monday and Tuesday, we had the Phil and Friends playing at the Capitol Theater, March 4th and 5th. And these shows were his regular Phil birthday shows. His birthday is March 15th, so just a few days from now. And this year, Phil will turn 84. Now, 84, that's we're talking old. 80, yeah, that was one thing. That was cool and nice to see. But 84, who is it 84 years old standing up playing 3 hours of rock and roll, singing and doing all the stuff that he's doing? And we're not going to count Mick Jagger because we all know that he can still run circles around everybody. But Phil is up there just doing this. And most importantly, he's doing it with the quintet, right? And the quintet is Jimmy Herring of Widespread Panic. On lead guitar, you have Warren Haynes of Warren Haynes playing the rhythm guitar. You have Rob Baracco on the keyboards and doing some great singing. Whenever they all get together, you can always count on Rob whipping out and doing that rag, which is a great classic song from the late 60s, early 70s, that Jerry, you know, always just used to love to play. And Rob just nails it. He always does it really, really well. And then, of course, John Molo on the drums. And I've always said, with all apologies to Joe Russo, who is obviously a fantastic drummer, and Jay Lane, who's an exceptional drummer, Molo's always been my favorite post-Jerry drummer. And I think he really enjoys playing with the quintet. He's always back there hamming it up and having a good time and, you know, just keeping the beat going and driving the band forward. And it's such a pleasure to see all of these wonderful musicians together. It was one of the first original conglomerations that Phil put together way back in like 2003 or 4, I want to say. And, you know, most of the time he doesn't have the quintet, you know. Jimmy Herring's out touring with Widespread. They tour quite a bit. And Warren Haynes is always touring and playing with somebody. Rob Baracco is out bouncing around with various dead groups. And John Molo's just keeping the beat for, you know, anybody who will bring him in and let him play. And you know, when they do, that's great because he's just such a talented guy. So it's unfortunate this time I was not able to make it out to the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York, for those shows. The last time they played as the quintet out there in 2021, I went with good buddy Mikey for my birthday, and he was kind enough to take me out there for that. And we really enjoyed it and had a great time. And three nights then of the quintet was, as you know, as much as we could handle, but I'm sure we could have handled more. And these are, you can find them on archive or wherever you go to listen to your live music. And I would very, very strongly recommend that you check out the quintet this year or any other year. They're just great. And when they get together and start whooping and hollering, I don't think there's very many places, at other places, musically speaking, that I would rather be. And I'm sure that's probably true for a number of Deadheads who, you know, have really looked to Phil to kind of be the guiding light in the post-Jerry world. No disrespect to Dead and Company or Rat Dog or Bobby and the Wolf Brothers, who are all great, but there's just something about Phil when he gets it together, and especially with the quintet, that really makes for a fun time. So the quintet played, and we're all the better for it because the music is out there for us to listen to. In addition, Phish has announced a summer tour, and I got to tell you, you know, sometimes they seem to be avoiding Chicago and we can't get them to come through or anything like that, but you got to be careful what you wish for, because when it rains, it pours. So, you know, I've been talking about the fact that in mid-August, I'm going to be heading out to Delaware for Phish Festival out there, and I know it's already got a name. I haven't learned the name yet. I hear people use it all the time. I'm old. I'll figure it out eventually. But looking forward to going out there for four shows with my son and his crew, who were kind enough to invite me along so that I could have a real, true Phish experience, a Phish Festival with real, true Phish fans. So I think that will be a great time, and very, very excited about it. But in the meantime, in July, we've got Phish playing three nights at Alpine, and then from there they go on to play two nights in St. Louis, and from there they go on to play three nights at Deer Creek, and then two nights in Grand Rapids. All of these places are within 4.5 or 5 hours. St. Louis is probably the farthest away of all of them. But if I went to all of them, that would be 10 shows, and then still leaving town the next month to go out to Delaware. You got to know when to hold them, boys, and I don't want to push my luck, so I'm thinking that I'm going to do Alpine, because they love Alpine, and they always play great shows up there, and Alpine's a great place to see them, and I got to go see them in St. Louis, because why not? You know, St. Louis is my home base. I saw them play there at the Fox Theater in 2009 when Cool Cousin Brent scored us really great seats in one of the private boxes, Phish is Phish right now. This is still them, right? All the original members, all the original everything. And quite frankly, they're killing it right now. When we were out in California, I was out in California this past week and visiting some good friends, cousins and family members out there, some of who are Phish fans. And we were checking out the Mexico shows a couple of nights, and those were just excellent. Just so much fun. A great Ruby Waves one night that, you know, really kind of brought the house down, and as everyone knows, is very special to me with my brand new, not so brand new granddaughter Ruby anymore, who at least arguably was named for the song. But you know, when they're jamming like that, and they're getting into good stuff like that. It was actually, I think, Ruby Waves into Golden Age, and then back into Ruby Waves, and I love the Golden Age cover too. So, you know, that would be wonderful. We should be so lucky that somewhere in all of these next round of shows I'm going to be going to, that we'll pick up something like that. But I'm very excited to have a summer full of Phish coming up, and just to get to that, back to that live music that always so defined the summer when we were waiting to find out where and when the Dead were going to be playing, and we would hit the road, and now doing it. And it, you know, brings back great memories, but it's a great time to create new memories with my son, with his friends, with my friends in St. Louis, some of whom have never seen Phish before, and we're going to be dragging them along to some shows down there. And so, you know, you can check it. I think you have, well, actually, I think you had until today. So if you haven't done it by today, I think you could still do it today until like 5 p.m. But I wouldn't wait. I'd rush in and get your names in the listing for the drawings when they start pulling for these shows. You know, if you miss them all, don't blame me, because I think they're going to be great and a lot of fun. But that is Phish, and we're not quite there yet, but we will be. And I also want to give a shout out to a very good friend of the show, Jay Blakesburg, the photographer for the Dead and just about any other cool jam band that you can think of out there. And we're working on getting Jay on the show. He's got a very busy schedule right now, but as always, is kind enough to talk with us and give us great ideas. And we're shooting for end of April, beginning of May with Jay. And as soon as we have him locked in, we'll let you know, because our episodes with Jay are always fun. We always learn new things, and he has the best stories around. But I do just want to drop two quick things. The first is, and I may have mentioned this last time, Jay purchased a large, from Dan Healy, former Dead soundboard guy, a huge box of, you know, Dead stuff, right? The kind of stuff that your mother would make you throw away, or that, you know, your average fan may or may not be into, but the people who love the Dead are into it, right? So they have, like, the Dead's tour books from all their tours. And a tour book is basically just what it sounds like, a notebook that has separate pages for each night, where they're staying, the telephone numbers for the hotels, who their transportation is, their flight information from one city to the next. Just, you know, chock full of absolutely meaningless information, unless you're a Deadhead and you really love to see that kind of stuff. And backstage passes from shows, and guitar clips, and I mean, just all sorts of stuff that's, you know, is what it is. But I was lucky enough to be able to stop by Jay's when I was out there really a week ago now. And he was showing me this stuff, and he was kind enough to let me step in and make a quick purchase, and I am now the proud owner of an official program, the official printed program that was handed out to the attendees of the Grateful Dead shows at the pyramids in Egypt in 1978. So had to lay out a few dollars for that. The wife wasn't necessarily thrilled about it, but, you know, sometimes you got to grab a piece of Dead history when you have that moment to be able to do so. And years from now, when people are saying, wow, this is from the 1978 shows, how cool is that? You know, and I'm going to be able to say, yeah, wasn't quite there, wasn't quite old enough to be doing that kind of traveling to see the Grateful Dead. But it's a part of history, and I'm very excited to have it. And thank Jay tremendously for, you know, creating a situation where this was even possible. Keep your eyes open, because there's going to be advertisements coming out soon for some big auctions that Jay's going to be holding to move some of this stuff and raise some money for some very charitable purposes. But that was the first thing. Then the second thing we just happened to discover while we were out there in San Francisco, that Jay has an exhibit going, an exhibition. And it was at the Contemporary Jewish Museum, and it was just incredible, incredible, incredible. Photographs of Jay that are almost like a life's work, all on film, nothing electronic there. Photos from when he first got interested in his cameras, when he was still in high school with all of his high school buddies doing all sorts of crazy high school buddy kind of stuff. His photos from his early days taking pictures of the Dead, and then lots of other Dead-related pictures. Then a whole series of portraits of various musical performers and other people associated with the music industry and the jam band industry. My favorite was his trio of portraits of Owsley Stanley, Ken Kesey, and Timothy Leary, sorry, and Timothy Leary, who, you know, could arguably be said to be, you know, the three main pillars, the three major players of the LSD, the birth of LSD, and its mark on America, the world, the rock and roll scene, the Grateful Dead, the acid trips, anybody that you can think of, right? Owsley Stanley was the guy who made it, and Timothy Leary was the Harvard professor who studied it and took many trips, and Ken Kesey was the guy who they tested it on in the 1950s at the Army testing grounds out in the Bay Area, and he discovered its magic and worked to get supplies of it to eventually turn the Merry Pranksters onto it, who then turned a lot of the San Francisco musical scene onto it in the epic acid tests that they had in the mid to late 1960s when the Grateful Dead became the house band and really launched the whole Grateful Dead movement. So there's a lot in those three photographs. According to Jay, it's the only known portrait of Owsley Stanley, who, due to his various legal issues, was always understandably very reluctant to have his picture taken in any way that might identify his location to law enforcement personnel who were still looking to make a name for themselves by busting LSD Millionaire or LSD Millionaire. And we've told that story about how when he was busted, they all got a kick out of it because it said LSD Millionaire arrested, and they turned it into LSD Millionaire and wrote a cute little song about it. That maybe we'll play again someday. But Jay's exhibit just goes through, to other live performances and just so many cool things. It took us, my wife and I, a little bit more than an hour to go through the whole thing. And just as we were finishing, Jay was showing up to show some other people through. And we were lucky enough to be able to tag along on that tour as well. And the stories were absolutely amazing. And I'm not going to tell them all now because I want Jay to tell them when we have him on the show. But if you're going to be in the Bay Area anytime, I don't know how much longer the exhibit's going to be there, but if you're going to be in the Bay Area anytime, let's say within the next month or so, you should really make a point of reaching out to the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco to see if, in fact, the exhibit is still there. And if it is, I cannot urge you enough to go out there and check it out and see this tremendous sample of Jay's work and all the other, you know, wonderful little things he has on display there, his cameras and, again, you know, more press passes and just all sorts of stuff. And you can even, get an earphone, headphone thing where you can listen to Jay tell the stories of what it is you're looking at. So highly recommended. Great stuff going on with Jay Blakesburg. And we will certainly have him on the show soon, and we'll give everyone a little bit of advance notice because that's going to be one you don't want to miss. Rolling ourselves back into our wonderful concert from 31 years ago today at the lovely Rosemont Horizon in Rosemont, Illinois. Let's dive back in with more song, another song from the first set. So So Many Roads was first performed by the Grateful Dead on February 22, 1992. It was then played regularly through the last performance of the song on July 9, 1995 at Soldier Field. In total, the Dead played the song just over 50 times. Jerry spoke about So Many Roads in an interview with Dave DiMartino in 1992, saying, "It's Hunter writing me from my point of view, you know what I mean? We've been working together for so long that he knows what I know. The song is full of references to things that have to do with me. Hunter's the only guy that could do that. He can write my point of view better than I can, I think. You know what I mean? So this is the kind of relationship we have. And he frequently writes tunes from my point of view that are autobiographical. They're actually biographical, I guess. He's the one writing them. But even so, they express my point of view. And more than that, they express the emotional content of my soul in a certain way that only a long-term and intimate relationship with a guy as brilliant as Hunter can cough up. I can sing that song and feel totally comfortable with it." And Robert Hunter, commenting on the origins of this song, said, "One afternoon, Jerry was playing some unstructured changes on the piano, figuring they might be forgotten. Otherwise, I clicked on my tape recorder. 10 years later, I found the tape and listened to it. I liked it and set these words to it. Listening to the pitiful recorded and time-degraded tape, Jerry protested that although he liked the words, his changes were not very good and unfinished. This didn't seem to be the bass, and I requested that he at least give it a run-through. The result was one of the better-received new Grateful Dead songs and one that almost got away. It was never released on a Dead studio album, but was a centerpiece on the Dead's first box set, So Many Roads, a five-disc retrospective of the band over their 30 years, and this song is prominently featured on the fifth disc, in particular, the version from Soldier Field, the last one, a very, very moving song. Many of the commentators on the archive.org board where I found the song said that they thought this was maybe one of the best ones ever, although I still think that the one that they played the last night at Soldier Field, it was like Jerry woke up from a bad dream for a little while and just cranked it out, and it was absolutely beautiful. You know, when I saw when I first saw the show in this show in 1992 at the Rosemont Horizon, we were still all just basically hearing the song for the first time and, you know, getting used to it. Over time, it became a very favorite one, thanks to Hunter's lyrics, Jerry's playing and singing, very emotional. I picked this part of the song because I especially like that harmony that he has with Bobby on the "Thought I Heard a KC Whistle Blow and Sweet and Low, Thought I Heard a KC Whistle Moan." You know, and it's really just a little quick harmony right there. It doesn't necessarily continue throughout the entire song, but it just really hits an oomph as they lead into that verse, which I think is the second verse of the song. And it's just a great, great, great tune, great to listen to. And yeah, you know, these guys really nailed it, Jerry and Hunter with this, and they both go out of their way to give praise to the other guy, which is their style. But the truth is that, you know, they both just deserve so much credit for it. You know, Jerry takes those lyrics and then does great things with them. Hunter hears the music and writes lyrics that fits the song. Jerry gets up there with his beautiful guitar and, you know, a very mournful voice kind of as he sings it. You know, he has that tiredness in his voice that the song suggests, having been down so many roads and, you know, been at this for a while, that it's just really beautiful and really fun to hear. Now we're going to flip it, and we're going to go to the opening song of the second set, which is definitely a little bit more of Jerry being upbeat and rocking out.
No.
Aiko Aiko. It's a great tune. It's wonderful, fun to hear. Great way. So you got a show where they open up the show with Help Slip Frank, and then you got a second set opener of Aiko. I mean, really, you know, if you're a Deadhead, you just can't really ask for much more than them. It's a much-covered New Orleans song. It tells of a parade collision between two tribes of Mardi Gras Indians and the traditional confrontation. The song, under the original title Giacomo, was written and released in 1953 as a single by James Sugarboy Crawford and his Cane Cutters, but it failed to make the charts. The story tells of a spy boy, i.e. a lookout for one of the band of Indians, encountering the flag boy or guy or Gideon carrier for another tribe. He threatens to set the flag on fire. Crawford set phrases chanted by Mardi Gras Indians to music for the song. Crawford himself states that he had no idea what the words mean, and that he originally sang the phrase Giacomo, but the title was misheard by Chess Records and Chess Records president Leonard Chess, who misspelled it as Giacomo for the record's release. The song first became popular in 1965 by the Dixie Cups, who scored an international hit with Aiko Aiko. In 1967, as part of a lawsuit settlement between Crawford and the Dixie Cups, the trio were given part songwriting credit. In 1972, Dr. John had a minor hit with his version of Aiko Aiko on his album Gumbo, which is a great, great version of it also. So here it's the second set opener. You know, from the intro, it was very hard to tell if they were going to go into Women Are Smarter or into Aiko. Really enjoy Women Are Smarter, but we were always a little bit extra happy when it turned out to be Aiko. And, you know, this was a great version. Jerry very energetic and getting into it, a little jazzy. You know, and instead of my spot boy, see your spot boy, this time he has, you know, my meringue sees your meringue, or if you're gonna, you know, do what the big chief says. You know, Jerry just kind of improvising on the fly, but keeping the song fresh and fun, just, you know, always a favorite for so many reasons. And you know, usually I would kind of tie it into, if they're playing Aiko, they just must be in a really good mood and in for a little bit of a celebration, because every time I heard it was just such a happy, uplifting tune, and they were always having fun, and Jerry roaring out the hey nows and everybody yelling back hey now, and just going back and forth on it and back and forth, and really a wonderful thing. So great fun to see Aiko as a second set opener. And it was a really, really good version. Now we're going to go into something here from the Dead that's a little bit different, something that was not done very often by them. And so I feel kind of lucky that, you know, we got to catch it when we did. And we're sitting there listening to the Grateful Dead in the middle of space when all of a sudden this is what we hear.
It's amazing just being here with Jerry, with you, with the greatest band anywhere in the universe. I got me this island that I'm calling me. Every time that I go there, you know who I see. You can see me and me more often than not, and that's pretty often. It's my favorite spot. Oh, there are plenty of spots called other than me, but there's someone else's. One look, and you'll see. You could try like a fool to be what you're not. The island you get is the island you got. God love you.
Ken Nordine.
Well, I kind of jumped the gun there, but yes, Ken Nordine. Who is Ken Nordine? Well, we weren't even quite sure at the time, although some people did, you know, people who listened to public broadcasting and stuff like that. He was an American voiceover and recording artist, best known for his series of word jazz albums. His deep resonant voice has also been featured in many commercial advertisements and movie trailers. One critic wrote that you may not know Ken Nordine by name or face, but you'll almost certainly recognize his voice. In 1955, he provided voiceover on Billy Vaughn's version of Shifting Whispering Sands, which peaked at number 5 on the Billboard Hot 100. He subsequently attracted wider attention when he recorded the aural vignettes on Word Jazz, 1957, Love Words, Son of Word Jazz from 1958, and his other albums in this vein, featuring Nordine's narration over Cool Jazz by the Fred Katz Group, featuring Chico Hamilton, recording under an alias. Nordine began performing and recording such albums at the peak of the Beat era and was associated with the poetry and jazz movement. However, it has been observed that some of Nordine's writings are more akin to Franz Kafka or Edgar Allan Poe than to the Beats. Many of his Word Jazz tracks feature critiques on societal norms. Some are lightweight and humorous, while others reveal paranoid undercurrents and bizarre dreamlike scenarios. Nordine's DVD, The Eye Is Never Filed, was released in 2007. Nordine hosted the weekly Word Jazz program on WBEZ, was carried on other stations from the 1970s for over 40 years. In 1990, Nordine was actually approached by Jerry to be the anchor of their New Year's Eve radio broadcast from Oakland, California. For the broadcast, he recorded some improvisations with Garcia, with drummer Mickey Hart, and Egyptian musician Hamza El-Din. This subsequently led to an album, Devout Catalyst, released on the Grateful Dead's own label in 1991, and Upper Limbo in 1993, an appearance with the band live at a show at Rosemont, Illinois on March 13th, 1993. And Ken died on February 16th, 2019. So we actually heard Ken doing his Word Jazz version of his work, The Island. A few minutes earlier in the same space, he also performed one called Fliberty Jib, which is actually kind of takeoff on why are all these people here looking at this group up on a pedestal in front of everybody and playing music. So he's talking about the Grateful Dead and a Grateful Dead experience. But if you're sitting at a Dead show in the middle of space and you're already out there, folks, right? You know, you've already launched out there a little bit, and all of a sudden you hear this booming voice come over the loudspeaker. You know, and the first thing you recognize right away, well, this isn't like an emergency announcement or anything. He's doing something. And then you kind of have to figure out what it is. And everybody's looking to see if they can see him on stage. And everybody's asking, who is this guy? What is he doing? Again, you know, some of the hipsters knew, stuff like that. But, it was just Ken Nordine. And apparently Ken Nordine did not pop into Grateful Dead concerts and do this very often. So we were very happy that we got to hear him come out and perform a little bit of his Word Jazz. And it was certainly very, very interesting and something that we really, really liked a lot. Now I am going to take a moment and dive back over into our talk of the day on cannabis. We've got some interesting things going on. So Dan, if you want to kick it off and lead us in, we're ready for you. Adios and via condito. Yeah, I'm leaving GA. Gonna lay in the hot sun and roll a big fat one and grab my guitar and play. Zac Brown Band, Toes. It was released in July 2009 as the third single from the band's 2008 major label debut studio album, The Foundation. The song became their second number one hit and their third top 10 on the U.S. Billboard Hot Country Songs chart in November 2009. In the song, Zac says adios to George and heads to the tropics for a getaway where he rolls a fat one and plays his guitar on the beach, all with his toes in the water and his ass in the sand. You know, you can't do it much better than that. So thank you, Dan, as always, for giving us a little intro into all of this. And let's start with some interesting business news. Not many people probably follow this, but if you do, it should have caught your eye the way it did mine. Marijuana multi-state operator Trulieve Cannabis Corp. revealed that it has received $113 million worth of tax refunds as it challenged what was owed under Section 280E of the IRS code. Florida-based Trulieve made waves in the U.S. marijuana industry when it announced the plan to seek $143 million worth of federal tax refunds in October 2023. Trulieve is also seeking $31 million in state tax refunds. And this all came out in Trulieve's fourth quarter earnings report that was just released last week. It received $62 million worth of tax refunds during the quarter ending December 31st. It received a total of $113 million in refunds to date, including $50.3 million received in January 2024. It also received one rejection notice for a refund in the amount of $1.2 million. Trulieve did not specify whether the successfully rejected refunds came from the federal government or the state governments. During a Thursday earning call, Trulieve executives were asked whether the company's tax refund strategy is applicable to other cannabis operators. Trulieve CEO Kim Rivers said she couldn't reveal more details about what she called a trade secret, but added that the company considers the tax refund strategy to be in large part specific to our position and our organization. We're not going to be sharing that information publicly, given the fact that it could be in a litigation posture, she said. That information might be available if and when we actually get in to court filings that would be a matter of public record. Trulieve Chief Financial Officer Wes Getman said the company is still accruing money to pay off its tax liabilities in the face of uncertainty. Until this process reaches a final resolution, we anticipate the uncertain tax position will increase over time. We will continue to make timely payments as ordinary corporate taxpayer. So, interestingly enough, we have a company that may have discovered the secret sauce on how to fight with the IRS over 280E deductions. Interestingly, but not surprisingly, they don't want to share it because they see it as a trade secret. Certainly, if they can find a way to not get hit by 280E, Trulieve stands to profit in a way that all other dispensaries won't, because they're all going to get hit by 280E. Makes a big difference. You know, when you're getting taxed on 60 or 70% of your gross revenue as opposed to only 30 or 40% of your gross revenue. You know, and in a perfect world, we'd all certainly like to see Trulieve say, hey, you know, we could get an advantage off of this, but in the interest of a robust and, you know, roaring and healthy marijuana industry, we want to share this with the entire industry. Because as we always say, when everyone, you know, everyone benefits when one person benefits. And, you know, it's imperative on the big MSOs to not crush the mom and pops, the smaller players who come along after the MSOs are well settled in and, you know, and rolling in the big bucks. You know, we need the smaller people to keep improving the quality of the various strains that are out there, bringing in better genetics, all the things that the big guys just don't want to do because they're making enough money doing what they are doing, so they don't really seem to be ultra motivated to go in and do anything else. But, you know, I mean, you know, I understand where Trulieve is coming from. They paid their accountants and their legal counsel good money, I'm sure. But as they indicate, if there is litigation, then there's a good likelihood that a lot of this will all come out and people will have an opportunity to look at it and, you know, get a better idea over exactly how they're making their arguments for relief under 280E that are, in fact, successful arguments. And, you know, anytime anybody in the marijuana industry is successful in fighting the IRS, it's something I think for all of us to celebrate and be very happy about. And hopefully, as I say, there will come a point in time where others will have an opportunity to benefit from this, and that we will have a much stronger industry where people can really make profits and not have to worry about their profits being gobbled up by the government under 280E. So this is one we want to keep an eye on, and we will, as Trulieve continues its final negotiations with the IRS, and we see if they get the relief they're looking for or if they're going to be forced to go into court and seek it that way. So we will find out what we can about that. Thank you to MJ Biz Daily for providing the content for this story. Switching over now, we've got a couple of stories coming to us from Marijuana Moment, and both of these stories go into the category of, well, duh, right? We know this, we've been saying this, and hopefully everybody else will say it now too. People who use marijuana take more walks on average compared to non-users and e-cigarette users, according to findings of a new study that challenged the stereotype of cannabis consumers, i.e. stoners, being less active. The study published in the Journal of Preventive Medicine reports late last month also found that marijuana consumers are no less likely to engage in basic exercise and strength training compared to non-users. Researchers at the University of Texas at Dallas and Ohio University carried out the study, which was based on data on 2,591 adults who participated in the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent to Adult Health from 2016 to 2018. Results indicated that participants' marijuana and e-cigarette use predicted their walking for exercise, with marijuana users walking the highest number of times per week, followed by non-users, e-cigarette users, and dual users, they found. However, this effect only approached significance after controlling for covariates. There were no significant differences in strength training or general exercise between groups. The author said the study is among the first of its kind to explore the relationship between marijuana and e-cigarette use and exercise behavior, accounting for exercise types. They concluded marijuana use is not significantly related to engagement in a particular type of physical activity, findings that challenge the stereotype that marijuana and e-cigarette users are less active than their non-using counterparts. As to the question of why marijuana consumers seem to walk more often than non-cannabis users, the study authors theorized that this may be due to some adults using cannabis to increase their motivation for enjoyment of exercise or the concentration of marijuana use in a particular urban area. People who live in large American cities, which tend to be in states where medical and recreational marijuana are legal, also tend to use public transport and walk more, they said. To the point about increased enjoyment with cannabis use, a study published in December also found that marijuana consumers prior to exercise can lead to greater enjoyment and an enhanced runner's high. Another study published last July surveyed 49 runners and found that participants experienced less negative effect, greater feelings of positive effect, tranquility, enjoyment, and dissociation, and more runner's high symptoms during their cannabis versus non-cannabis runs. So, you know, this is not insignificant. We have a number of people who are saying, oh, well, no, you don't want to smoke marijuana because if you do, you're going to be a couch potato. You're never going to go out. You're never going to do anything. But guess what? That prejudice doesn't hold up either. And now here's another study that tells us that. And, you know, we can see directly from this that if you smoke, you're just as likely and maybe even more likely to get up and to do your workouts and all of that. That's an important point because, again, it battles this notion that's constantly pressed by the prohibitionists that, you know, if you smoke marijuana, you're never going to want to do anything. You're going to be sitting on a couch in your mother's basement for the rest of your life, asking her to make you grilled cheese sandwich, you know, while you play Nintendo or, you know, Spacebox or whatever any of these games are called, you know, with your equally stoner buddy, you know, living the life that everyone predicted you would live if you crossed the threshold and started smoking. So I think it's very, very important that people understand that a lot of that is a myth, and that's what these studies promote, right? That all the warnings that people are giving us and all the negative prejudices that we've all come to know and understand really don't hold water in most instances once they're put up to meaningful testing and studying. And this is just another example of that, where if somebody who doesn't want marijuana around is telling you, I don't want it because I don't want to turn everybody in my world into a bunch of zombies, you now have an opportunity to be able to come back to them and say, don't worry, based on our studies that we've seen, that's not going to happen. Here's the other good news. Marijuana use is associated with lower odds of subjective cognitive decline, according to a new study, with people who consume cannabis for recreational or medical purposes, reporting less confusion and memory loss compared to non-users. The study, which showed that recreational cannabis use is significantly linked to lower SCD, subjective cognitive decline, is especially notable given that past research has connected subjective decline to the development of dementia later in life. The results, which were published in the journal Current Alzheimer Research this month, indicate that THC's impact on cognitive function may be more complicated than popularly assumed. Compared to non-users, the study says, non-medicus cannabis use was significantly associated with 96% decreased odds of SCD. People who reported using marijuana for medical purpose or for both medical and recreational also showed decreased odds of SCD, although not as significant, the study found. To be sure, A number of earlier studies have indicated negative associations between heavy cannabis use and mental performance. Authors of the new study out of SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse pointed to results, to past results linking long-term or frequent cannabis use to compromised verbal recall performance, worsened cognitive function, and subjective memory complaints, for example. However, they say, the cognitive implications of cannabis are not only determined by the frequency of cannabis consumption, they wrote, noting that other factors, including product formulation, method of administration, and reason for use, may also impact the cognitive effects associated with cannabis use. They go on, our study addresses these knowledgeable gaps by comprehensively examining how reason, frequency, and method of cannabis use are associated with SCD among U.S. middle-aged and older adults, the report says. The survey asks respondents, during the past 12 months, have you experienced confusion or memory loss that is happening more often or is getting worse? They could respond yes, no, don't know, not sure, or refuse the question. Results were analyzed across three cannabis variables: frequency of use over the past month, ranging from 0 to 30 days, reason for cannabis use, which included non-user, medical, non-medical, or both, and the method of cannabis consumption: non-user, smoke, eat, drink, vaporize, dab, or other. We found that non-medical cannabis use was significantly associated with reduced odds of SCD in comparison to non-users. So, you know, there you have it. It goes on to talk more about this, and it's another study worth reading, but another one that battles all of the traditional myths and prejudices and you know, mistruths about marijuana that we get from people. It's gonna, you know, it's gonna make you lose your memory. It's gonna give you cognitive decline. And again, once it's actually being tested and subject to, you know, medical testing and studies like it is here, guess what? The answers don't hold up to what we've been warned about all of our lives. To the contrary, the evidence from these studies suggests that all the lies we've been told our whole lives are just in fact that, lies, or at best, to be polite, statements that are not backed up by fact or have no factual basis for people to be talking about them. And, you know, that's just as important as anything. And it's important for us to see these studies. They're reaffirming, both in terms of the fact that, yes, we really have been lied to, and also in terms of the fact that for people who may have some concerns about whatever their level of cannabis use is, that it's not going to negatively impact your desire to exercise. It's not going to cause cognitive decline, at least not in the overwhelming majority of cases that they reviewed. And these are important factors that people should know about and have honest answers to be able to evaluate when everyone makes a decision about whether or not cannabis is something that they think they want to use, whether it is for medical or non-medical purposes. So, you know, thank you to all of these authors of all of these reports who are really setting the record straight for us and, you know, really laying out there what's going on and what this is all about. And quite frankly, you know, based on what they're saying, it all seems pretty good. And that's nice to know. You know, I'd like to say it's not surprising, because we all like to think that, you know, marijuana is just something that God or our creator or Mother Nature or whoever you believe in, this is natural. This is provided by the earth, and it provides results to us that are similar to results you can get from using pharmaceutical-produced drugs. But why have to go through that and worry about all the other things that they're putting in the pharmaceutical drugs when we know that we have natural remedies for these things? And marijuana is one of those natural remedies. And when consumed, you know, by people appropriately, just like if you drink appropriately, but in this case, if you're consuming marijuana appropriately, it can provide well-recognized medical benefits. And as a result of any of these studies we read, that's more than sufficient to get it removed from Schedule 1, at a minimum down to Schedule 3, if not completely off of the scheduling altogether. But don't forget, this is where all the loudly screaming prohibitionists out there, you know, like to sit there and tell us about all the bad things that will happen to us. And, you know, again, guess what? They're wrong. We're right. So they need to step aside and allow marijuana to be used out there in all states and across the country, so people can both get the medical benefits that they receive from it, and other people can get the other benefits, the relaxing benefits, the social benefits, all the reasons why they like to smoke marijuana, but, you know, are concerned about doing it because of negative public perceptions and things like that. So, good stories all the way around, and it's always nice to have positive marijuana stories to report. So we're running out of time. We're going to close with one final song. But before we do it, I just want to talk about it just a little bit. It's Days Between. It's a song by Robert Hunter and Jerry Garcia. Was perhaps their last collaboration on a big significant song. It won that ranks, some people say, with Dark Star and Terrapin as ambitiously and intentionally grand, really taking it to another level. And, you know, I suppose that you could certainly see that. It appeared like ghostly ships it describes, as if gradually from a fog and only slowly revealing itself as something very big, towering above everything around. It's hard to say it any better than Phil did in his autobiography, Searching for the Sound. Achingly nostalgic, Days Between evokes the past. The music climbs laboriously out of shadows, growing and peaking with each verse, only to fall back each type and hope. Time and hopeless resignation. When Jerry sings the line, when all we ever wanted was to learn and love and grow, or gave the best we had to give, how much we'll never know, I'm immediately transported decades back in time to a beautiful spring morning with Jerry, Hunter, Barbara Mayer, and Alan Trist, all of us goofing on the sheer exhilaration of being alive. I don't know whether to weep with joy at the beauty of the vision or with sadness at the impassable chasm of time between the golden past and the awful, painful present. The song was notable because each verse in the song contains 14 lines. Each evokes a different season of the year, although not in sequence. The first verse contains the line, "Summer flies and August dies. The world grows dark and mean." I can't hear that line without thinking about August West and Wharf Rat, and by extension, Garcia himself. The singing man is at his song, the holy on their knees. Who is the singing man if not Garcia? And when it comes to Hunter and his words, you know, all beautifully said and very appropriate for a song like this. Played 42 times by the band, always in the second set, almost always out of drums. And, you know, that's kind of a counter to So Many Roads, which we in this concert was played in the first set, but in many other concerts where I saw it was played in the second set. So it was one that moved around, but Days Between was always pretty comfortably ensconced there, I think, as the second set, typically post-drums, Jerry ballad. They played it 42 times, as we said, first on February 26, 1993 at the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum in Oakland, the last time on June 24, 1995 at RFK Stadium in Washington, D.C. This concert from 31 years ago was just the second time it had ever been played. And I have to agree with Phil, gave the best we had to give, how much we'll never know. What a beautiful thought. What a beautiful, you know, representation from Jerry and from Robert Hunter and from the entire band, you know, to say these things. And it's just a really, really beautiful song. And I'll admit, my friend One Arm Larry out there will give me grief, because even as recently as the 2015 reunion shows, when he heard them sound checking it and he called me to tell me, and I was like, oh, really? Bobby plays it all the time. I can't say that I enjoy Bobby's version of it as much, but Bobby has this thing about playing it in Chicago. So whenever they're here, Bobby with Dead & Co. or with Wolf Brothers, or you can almost always expect him to play it. And, okay, you know, that's fine. It's beautiful to listen to, and it's all really wonderful. So we're going to leave you today with the Grateful Dead from 31 years ago. It's not the end of the show, but it's deep enough in the show, and the encore, Liberty, is, you know, one that I just don't get that excited about, although we will reach a show eventually where we're going to have to talk about it, and we will. But in the meantime, enjoy the Days Between. Have a great week. Stay safe, and as always, enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thanks, everyone. When all we ever wanted was to learn and love and grow, when we grew into our shoes, we told them where to go. Walked halfway around the world, on promise.
songs that move. Stood up on a mountaintop, walked barefoot through the snow. Gave the best we had to give. How much we'll never know. Never know.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
99.9% of our DNA is identical. It's a 0.1% that truly makes us different and unique. And that's what the show is about. Find out that 0.1% about your favorite guests. Find out what music they like, their first cannabis experience, and even what their room looked like growing up. But more importantly, or as important, their journey. Learn what makes them unique on Everything Is Personal.